Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady Zoo. What do I do when I'm not hosting Word of Mouth? I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, big brands, startups, all those doing what's most innovative and delicious. I recently headed out to SF and the Bay Area to talk to food folks out there for our SF sessions. Not live, but on location. So on today's Word of Mouth, we're recording on April 30th, 2014, from the studios of our partner company, Stitcher, a handy app you can use to listen to your favorite radio shows on demand and on the go. We're here with sommelier partner Mark Bright of the 2-Michelin-starred Saison restaurant in San Francisco. And he just got back from London, where he and his partner, Chef Josh Skeens, were awarded the San Pellegrino One to Watch. Hey, Mark.
Hello.
Lovely to have you on.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for taking, you know, one of the rare days that you're in town here to come on Word of Mouth.
I know, a pleasure.
So let's talk your travels, because I knew I definitely wanted to catch you and catch up with you. Let's see, it's like Hong Kong, Japan, Burgundy, London. I'm saying it all out of order. What's happening?
You know, there are periods of the year where I actually have pretty heavy travel. I try to stay in town as much as I can for the restaurant. But generally speaking, the spring and the fall, I organize trips for multiple projects that I do and different different categories of the beverage industry that I'm involved in different parts of the world. Whether it's sourcing, whether it's finding wine for collectors, or whether it's producing sake, you know, it's, you know, I try to condense it all, but it's a pretty heavy travel schedule.
Okay, so let's talk about the sake business. You're making sake in Japan.
Yeah, correct. I started my own label last year with a few brewers in different parts of rural Japan, and they're all kind of traditional families that, you know, have medium-sized breweries. Some of them, you know, this is their 10th generation making sake, so it's kind of a privilege to be working with them after so many years of having their sake and, you know, studying sake and being there and going there. So,
but you're going to do it differently.
Yeah, it's going to be different. You know, it's, you know, we're focusing this project kind of on the inability for, you know, people outside of Japan to really kind of relate to and find connections with sake and with brands. You know, a lot of it's out of fear of, you know, looking like they don't know what they're talking about, which, you know, even for me, working with sake for 10 years, I find it very difficult sometimes ordering in restaurants. So I created a brand that's focused on helping English speakers become more associated with sake by, you know, having English labels that really point out kind of like the three main factors of it, you know, the producer, you know, the type of sake and what region it comes from. You know, and it's just kind of like their labels are just spelled out. So,
what is your brand called?
Water and Rice Sake Company.
Interesting. You know Abe Schooner of Stolen Project, right?
Yes, I do.
He just did a.
Yeah. I've had many fun nights with him. He's a great winemaker.
He is a great winemaker, also a great getter together of people to blind taste. And mm-hmm. He just did a sake tasting yesterday that I was bummed to miss out on because, to your point, you know, I can navigate the world of wine and words of wine and the language of wine, but sake is actually a whole other animal, but with some of the same sort of, you know, questions to ask, the same, you know, bookshelf to put books on. Mm-hmm. So I just don't have that bookshelf yet, so I'm excited for this.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be really good. I think a lot of people are excited about that. I've been talking to, you know, around the country and in Japan, you know, I'm really happy that people in Japan have really received it very well and are very excited about the project because, you know, for them, it's been very difficult for them to kind of break into a lot of markets in the United States and really kind of promote sake consumption education. So I think everyone, you know, all around the world is pretty excited about having something that's going to make it a little more palatable.
Mm-hmm. And there's already one sake available at Saison right now?
Yeah, we have one of the sakes now at Saison from Shindo, mm-hmm. and which is a producer in Yonezawa in Yamagata, and you know this is a producer that's 10th generation father to son, very traditional. They make amazing sakes. You know, we actually use them in the pairing with the food early on in the menu with some of the raw fish dishes and those things.
But I don't think I got it.
Might not have got poured the other night when you had dinner.
Yeah, so. Well, I'll have to come back sooner rather than later.
Yeah, that's the thing about Saison, you know, the menus and the pairings, you know, they change every day. It's a constant evolution at the restaurant. So you, you know, even for me in the wine pairings, I get curveballs thrown from the kitchen all the time, so.
Love it. Okay, another business. You also make wine in Burgundy and in Santa Cruz.
Correct, yeah. So I have a project where I'm a little more hands-on in Santa Cruz, with the winemaking, with some great vineyard sites that are you know, limestone-based for the Pinot Noir and for the Chardonnays that we're working with. And, you know, they're really small production, but they're with a young winemaker, Ryan Beauregard, who's, you know, fourth generation down there in the mountains, but a great guy that I connected with years ago when I spent some time down there. And it's a really fun project, and, you know, the vineyard sites are absolutely amazing. You know, they're really the only vineyard sites with limestone, which is kind of like the base point for vineyards that you find in Burgundy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, you know, over in Burgundy right now, it's, you know, I've been doing a lot more kind of negotiant work than it is winemaking like it is in California,
mm-hmm.
Simply because, you know, it's really difficult to get grapes right now because, you know, the region of Burgundy has had four back-to-back really kind of small production vintages. So, you know, the producers themselves barely have enough grapes for them to produce their own wine. Nonetheless, they sell them out, so I've been kind of working with some great sellers and pulling out a lot of older Burgundies that have been kind of hidden away in Burgundy and need to get out to the world. So that's kind of the direction we've been taking over there, simply just because of Mother Nature.
So the other business in your incredible portfolio of everything that's yummy is wine brokering in mostly China?
Yeah, I've had an office brokerage for 5 years in Hong Kong, which is, you know, obviously everyone knows about Hong Kong and the wine market there, especially after the tax breaks years ago. And, you know, it's just been great because I've got a chance to kind of grow a network of really amazing collectors, very educated collectors too, you know, in Hong Kong and Taiwan and China and Japan and Singapore, you know. But I base most of the work out of Hong Kong just because of the tax-free element of getting wine to the consumers there. But
really, like completely?
Yeah, you know, I mean, a lot of other countries have really high tariffs and taxes to get wine into the country. That's why a majority of people in Asia, they do their purchasing and they keep their wine in Hong Kong because there's zero tax for them to pay for it. So you know, it's been great. But yeah, that community of collectors, you know, are great because, you know, it's like we get together a lot and you know, they have a great knowledge about wine, and they know exactly what they're looking for also. And, you know, so it's fun to see that kind of grow and expand in Hong Kong and the rest of Asia.
So how much of this is wine to invest and wine to drink?
I'm sorry?
How much of this is wine to invest with, or wine, and how much of it is wine to drink?
Oh, for the collectors? You know, there's a lot of great sellers in Hong Kong, but I will tell you one thing. They're definitely, in Hong Kong, the collectors are not afraid to drink their wines, you know?
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. A lot of these buyers buy it to enjoy it and consume it, not to hold it and to, you know,
that makes me
resell it later.
Very happy because life is short. And so everyone talks about wine in China, and everyone likes to sort of make these vast generalizations about how there are rich Chinese and there's a demand for big names, and, you know, people are willing to pay a whole lot, and prices are going up, and not necessarily is everybody sophisticated. So since you're actually doing business there, what can you tell us about what you've been surprised by?
Well, you know, I mean, if you look at China, you can kind of compare, you know, the level of knowledge and and kind of the market itself right now, if you look at the United States in the 60s, because not so long ago, you know, it was, you know, it was still an educational experience 50 years ago that, you know, in America, you should drink wine with food. And guess what? It goes with your dinner, and you shouldn't put ice in it. You know, we're not that far away from what we're talking about at in the Chinese market. But the one thing is you know, the Chinese market, the consumers there, because I do a lot of trade shows and a lot of education shows, and, like, you know, like the show I do in Hong Kong every year is 200,000 consumers come to it, and I talk to people all the time, and, you know, wow. they learn fast. And, you know, they're not sitting around drinking wine with Coca-Cola and those things like you hear the stories about. You know, I mean, maybe 10 years ago you saw a lot of that, but now that doesn't exist. They have a good knowledge of how to consume wine and what wine's about. And, you know, for them, you know, as you can see with the crash of the Bordeaux market, you know, it's not that they just want big names. You know, they understand quality, and they also understand price points, you know, and they're not paying the huge prices for wine anymore because, you know, they've found the they found winesearcher.com, and they know what the rest of the world's paying for it. So they're not, you know, they're not just paying anything for the wine anymore. They're, you know, they're educated consumers now. And they're, you know, and you know, they're consumers in a market that really need to be respected, because not only do they learn fast and catch on to wine and are enthusiastic about it, but, you know, it's going to be a huge market very soon of educated, you know, medium-income consumers. So, that, you know, it's going to be the people that go there and really, you know, share honestly the education wine and share honest wines with them and good wines, you know, and that are going to kind of win in that market overall.
Does wine education to that market as it is right now, you know, if it's going to be effective, does that look like what wine education here should look like, or at least making wine less intimidating and empowering people? I mean,
the same education goes with anywhere. You know, you just want to make sure that you're not, you know, making wine kind of a, you know, like a hidden secret. You know, you want to keep it open. It's not, you know, it's not just for the prestigious and those things. It's for everyday consumers, you know, and it's something delicious and fun, and it's relatively easy to understand. You know, the winemaking process and the different types of wine, those things, that's not difficult to understand. The thing that's difficult is going out and trying as many wines as you have access to find out what you like. That's where the real education comes in. Come on, you know, you pick the grapes, you make the wine, and it's not, I mean, it's not that simple of a process. But really, I mean, the main education part is those people going out on their own and tasting and finding things that they like and making sure that there's wine professionals that they have access to that give them proper, correct information, because for a long time, you know, they've been misinformed. By people that just do marketing.
My friend who moved there to work at a bank in Beijing tells me of one of those taxi cab shows. I guess they do shows in taxi cabs too there.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'm sure.
So they have some kind of wine professional, quote unquote, spouting off sort of semi-gibberish.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was like 4 years ago I heard about this. But anyway, China's moving very quickly.
You're talking about a television show that you would watch while you're riding in a taxi.
Yeah,
I've seen this show before. It's
is it bad?
I don't know. I don't speak Chinese, so I didn't know what he was saying. But it looked entertaining, to say the least.
Well, this person is someone who is a white American who speaks Chinese perfectly. So that might be, you know, why he was able to understand the teachings from this back of a taxi cab show. What's cool about you is that you still talk about wines to everyday wine drinkers at the restaurant, because you're at the on the floor when you can be, but then you're also working with highly sophisticated wine collectors and wine drinkers worldwide. So people trust you to pick wines for investment reasons. What determines whether someone is successful at that or not? You know, it's a really interesting investment category.
Oh, you mean what determines if a collector is a good investor? And wine, or
yeah, if you or your collectors make money,
you know, it's kind of funny because, you know, there's only for my collectors, you know, 98% of them buy wine because they love it, and they buy things that they want to drink themselves, because, you know, the number one response always to, like, you know, when they ask me about if a wine's gonna be worth more later in the future or not, you know, it's like, it's hard to determine. You know, some I say yes, I think that's gonna be worth more because it's a very small production wine and they're never gonna produce any more of it. It's great vintage, those things, the market's gonna drive for it. But they always at the end of the day say, well, you know, win or lose, I'm gonna be able to drink the wine. So, you know, it's like most collectors, anyone that's interested in wine, there's very few people I know that buy wine solely for investment. You know, they do it as a lifestyle investment, something fun, something that, you know, maybe worth more later in the future, but, you know, 9 out of 10 collectors that do buy wine, and even though the wine's worth more in the future, mm-hmm. they still end up drinking it. They mm-hmm. just, it's kind of like bragging rights of like, I got this before it was famous. You
Ooh.
Know, it's like, so, but yeah, no, majority of investors, you know, it's like the best investor in wine is the investor that buys what they like.
Absolutely, as with everything in life,
yeah.
go with, you know, your gut and with
just
what
like,
you
just
love.
Just like artwork, you know?
Mm-hmm. So are you then, you know, as the wine broker, are you measured? What criteria are you measured by in terms of success?
You know, one of the things really, you know, that collectors really need the biggest help with is not only education about the wine themselves, but, you know, the availability of the ability to get the wine that they want.
Mm.
You know, I specialize in Burgundy, and Burgundy is an extremely small production region in the world, you know, and you know, it's like it's very difficult, especially for people in Asia, to get their hands on a lot of the producers that they yep. want to find, just because, you know, they've done so much business with America and London and the rest of the world that, you know, they only make 200 cases, and if it's already spoken for, how is it going to get to Hong Kong? So, you know, I mm-hmm. help them with finding kind of the wines that they need to get their hands on. That's really what that I find they're most happy with, you know, is when I'm able to get the things that they need.
Interesting. I got a glimpse of your, you know, your communications and your deal making and connecting. It really is all about eating and drinking and connecting on the ride over here. And you said something that really gave me a look into your personality, or, you know, your motivations, which is that you love it when the puzzle pieces come together. Yes, this is what really feels good. So,
yeah, no, there's nothing. You know, it's kind of like a. Kind of like Indiana Jones, you know? it's like when you find the wine that you've been looking for 6 months for someone, you know, it's like it's really exciting. You know, the collector gets excited because you found it, it's in great condition, you know, you go, and then you get like nervous because it's like, you know, so you find it, you need to go and inspect the wine, and you're like, oh, is this going to be in good condition?
Oh, wow.
You know, is it going to be real? Is it going to be, you know? It's fun, you know, when you talk about like putting someone together that's been looking for wine for a long time and finding the wine for them finally, and it being good, and
mm-hmm.
then... You know,
and you escaped the big ball that was going to smush you?
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, always running away from the ball, so.
Well, I now know who to call in a couple years.
Yeah, yeah, no worries, anything you ever need.
My best wine buyer ever. how did you meet Josh Gaines?
We met in San Francisco 8 years ago, no, 9 years ago now. I've been here for 12 years, yeah, wow, it's a long time. 9 years ago now. We first originally met when he was at Chez TJ, and, you know, we really got a chance to know each other after that, but, like, you know, we would, you know, the industry is fun because, especially in Northern California, because the industry in Northern California is very, very connected with each other, you know, everyone kind of knows each other, everyone drinks with each other, everyone's very social and, you know, very communicative with each other, so, you know, we knew each other from just kind of hanging out and being a couple young guys in the food and wine industry and stuff, and then... He started working with Michael Mina after Chez TJ, and I was already working with Michael Mina and Raj Parr and those things like that. So we saw each other in the office a lot, and then, you know, he took over executive chef position for the opening when they took over the space down in St. Regis, Dana Point. And something came up, and I was sent down there to kind of do the sommelier work for a few weeks and those things. And then that's really, at that time when me and him had a lot of, like, very, like, close, intimate time in the restaurant every day, all day, you know, that's...
Ooh la la.
Yeah. that's when we really kind of realized, you know, I mean, not only that, you know, our friendship and stuff like that, because we knew each other before, and we knew we got along because we would go out and, you know, cause trouble and wreak havoc in San Francisco, but it's like, at that point, you know, it's like, we really got a chance to talk about food and wine and, like, our philosophies and stuff, you know, I mean, I could still remember where a lot of the... some of the best ideas and some of the best creativity. And one of the fondest moments, actually, I think, in my career was during that time in Orange County, because at the end of the night, he would cook a couple, two or three dishes that weren't on the menu there, things that he was just playing with, and we would put them out on this patio. There's this great patio down there at the restaurant, and we would put these, you know, he'd put these out on the patio, and me and him would sit there, and I would pick one or two wines as what I would think were pairings with mm-hmm. those dishes, and we would sit there and talk about the dishes and why the wine should go with it, what works and what didn't work and stuff like that, and we would do that every night, you know, and it was very fun, you know, he and I together were very creative and, like, able, we were able to work and and talk about food and wine, you know, very closely. We kind of had the same philosophies and understanding, so it was like, you know, it was kind of a natural combination.
Very bromanical.
Yeah, it was. It was very bromanical. Oh, man.
What's an example of one of those dishes he would just sort of throw out there and then you would sort of, like, improvise a beverage?
Oh, man, that was 7 years ago. It's hard to remember what a lot of those dishes were. But, you know, he was always very, you know, his food was always very pure. You know, mm-hmm. It was very ingredient-driven, and it was very minimalistic. You know, it wasn't something that you found with, like, four different sauces or heavy cream sauces or anything like that, you know, which was something that I always liked, you know, because... You know, his food was always, like, not to repeat it again, but, you know, it's very light and pure and clean, you know, and it's like, and for me, you know, I think white wine and food is generally speaking, one of my favorite pairings, so it was always
no
white wine.
Wonder I had all white wines until one red at the end, which I did not mind. I agree with you. I am a scholar of the Paul Greco school.
Yeah. So, I mean, so, you know, so you see, but that's just naturally how his menus and food have always been. It's always been, you know, very pure and light, you know. So for me, I really enjoyed that because I was able to pair a lot of white wines with it, not being a very heavy red wine drinker. So, you know, we just kind of, you know, hit it off. And it was kind of, you know, yeah. I mean, that was something I really liked about a lot of the first dishes that he started really doing in his own. And very vegetable-driven, too. Huge vegetables.
Oh, I loved the vegetables.
Yeah. I mean, that's a key. Vegetables, to me, I mean... I think about some of the most delicious things I've ever eaten in my life, mm-hmm. and with the exception of this bird that my friend cooked in Paris a couple days ago, which was probably one of the most delicious things I've ever eaten in France. Mm. Outside of that, vegetables are generally like what I love.
Was that bird at home?
Yeah, he cooked it. He cooked it at his house. You know, he got it from a small farm outside of Paris, and then he roasted it at the house just with the natural juices. And
what kind of bird?
Just chicken, a young chicken.
Oh.
So, you know, young PR, and then he cooked it up. It was great. Perfect. Drink a bottle of jam Coro tea with it, and then you know, some cheese and just fresh salad afterwards. Perfect meal.
Perfection.
Yeah.
So congratulations on the San Pellegrino One to Watch Award.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a yeah.
That's, what was that
it's
like?
Pretty amazing. You know, it's an amazing honor, and, you know, to have received the award and for that organization to, you know, to see what we're doing, to like what we're doing, and really, you know, to really motivate us and inspire us to keep working harder and really push harder, you know, because, you know, it's an amazing award. But, you know, what Josh and I have pulled from it is that, you know, it's like that, you know, what we've been working for, you know, is a good theory and is a good philosophy, and we should keep working hard at it because we're onto something good. You know, we're doing something right. So it's like, you know, it's motivational, but it's not, you know, we're not at the end of the road, and we never will be at the end of the road. You know, it's just...
We'll go to the theory in a second because it's an interesting theory and it's something that I absolutely agree with.
Yeah.
What was it like being in the room with all of the greats and then I didn't, you know, what was the award ceremony like?
Well, I mean, you know, the award ceremony, it was pretty, you know, I mean, it was one of those things where, okay, you know, it's the top 50, you know, all these chefs going to be there, you know, the award, you know, that you're getting is extremely significant, those things, but it doesn't really hammer home until you're sitting in the room, and it's a small room, and, like, all the chefs from the top 50 are there, and it's just like, you know, the camaraderie that you see amongst them. But just like seeing these people together, people that have spent their entire lives, you know, with the driving force and love and passion for the same thing that we love, but have obviously, you know, have crossed so many great, you know, feats and have gotten so many great accolades. It was amazing. It was really inspirational to be there. I was nervous as all hell to get on stage in front of everyone. Unfortunately,
because they only have like. Only a few people get to go up.
Yeah.
It's not all 50 or anything. It's not like a graduation ceremony.
No, it's not like
that.
A graduation ceremony. It's not. So maybe I can't remember, like 6 or 7 of us actually went on stage to actually receive a physical award.
Right.
And it was, you know, it was horrible because we got there and I mean, it was amazing, but it was like for me, it was like so nerve-wracking because we got
really?
There and like the first thing at the ceremony is they called us on stage. And I was just like, you know, I was at the end of the row and I turned to the right and there's a photographer there. And I'm like, do I go up there now? Like, oh, what do I do? I'm like, go. I'm like, okay. So I kind of like, I didn't know. It's like, and they give all the restaurants that are 1 through 50, they give them a scarf when you come in.
A scarf?
Well, you know, no, it's a ceremonial kind of thing, you know? Well, it's like, you know, it's like, you, I don't know.
The thing that, like, you know, the thing that you wear, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
and then
shiny.
Yeah, it's shiny and stuff. Yeah. They gave one to me, and you know, it's like when I came in, and I was like, wait, I'm not in the top 50. And because I asked someone, I was asking people, I'm like, what do I do with this thing? Like, is it for chefs? Because, you know, I'm not a chef. Like, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be, like, out of place or anything like that. And, like, and you know, anyway. Yeah, so it ended up being for just for the people in the 1 through 50, but they give the one to watch that,
yeah,
because it's a significant award. You know, it was just cool, and like, you know, the camaraderie of all the chefs and the after hours party was fun because I got a chance to talk to a lot of the chefs
and see
a lot of the other guys from America that I get to see during the year and stuff. But you know, also to see a lot of the European chefs and those things, and you know, talk to some of these guys, you know, that were just like inspirational. And you know,
who'd you get to catch up with?
You know, I got a chance to talk with Renee just real briefly, you know, those things from Noma, obviously, but he was, you know, celebrating as he should be, him and his team, so, you know. It was just, it was a great event. I mean,
He got number one, like, a third year in a...
No, he was number two last year.
Okay.
This is his fourth time, I believe.
Fourth time.
Yeah, so, and he, you know, he was the only one that allowed to give a speech during the ceremony.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so, I mean, It was a significant time, and you know, the after hours party with all the chefs and everything was an absolute blast. But I unfortunately can't tell you anything about that. So.
Okay, right? They make you sign a contract when you walk in.
We got the waivers. Don't worry.
And Josh is on his honeymoon right now.
Yeah, Josh on his honeymoon in Japan. You know, which is amazing. And you know he's dedicated so much to the restaurant for so long, and you know, his wife has been so, you know, understanding and, like, you know, so supportive of him that, you know, the honeymoon was booked before we got the announcement that we need to be at the Pellegrino thing. And I think, you know, she's been understanding enough, and there's no changing that. So I think they just moved forward with the wedding and the honeymoon. Yeah, you know, he's having a good time in Japan, though. You know, it's great. He really wishes he was there. I wish he was there, too, because, you know, just it didn't feel right receiving the award without him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know. Another time next year we'll be there together, hopefully.
It's all about balance in life.
Yeah, yeah. It's good that he's on his honeymoon. It's the first time he's been out of the restaurant really for any kind of period of time, so it's like, you know, it's good for him.
Balance is an important word.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go back to the concept you two originally came up with. I was surprised to learn that that Saison started out in a horse barn.
Yeah, so... I think, you know, I've had a lot of thoughts in the last 2 days since I've been traveling back, because I came back yesterday from London,
mm-hmm.
and here today, and it's like, you know, on the plane coming back, you know, and after the ceremony and like yesterday, you know, I've actually thought about it a lot, and I haven't like really like gone back to that time frame, you know, as Saison, the beginning of those things, and really thought about, like, you know, what we started for and how we got there and, like, what we worked for and, like, how, you know, how difficult some of the things were and the sacrifices we made. You know, it's just like I just started thinking about it again because, you know, when you get wrapped up in the day-to-day business of the restaurant, you kind of forget about what happened 5 years ago, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, no, you know, the main philosophy for us was, like, you know, we wanted to try to give the most ultimate dining experience. It wasn't about money or profit or anything like that or building a business. We just wanted to be the absolute best restaurant in the city. You know, it's like we wanted to serve the absolute best food and the best wine and the best experience. So, you know, we worked on it forever because we only wanted a 4-table restaurant, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, unfortunately, you know, you have to figure out a balance there to keep the doors open.
Yeah, make people sure are jumping on that to invest in.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, so it's like we have to find a little balance. So we have 8 tables now in the restaurant, which is still extremely small, you know. I mean, we still only do 25 to 30 people tops, you know, maybe. You know, it's like...
And it's tough because most people, just because they show up and pay $300 or $500 for just one person, they think that fine dining is where money is made, and that's, like, the exact opposite.
Yeah. Fine dining restaurants, and I think I could speak for a majority of fine dining restaurants
absolutely.
In the world, is not where... You sacrifice as much as you can, and you never compromise on quality, which means, unfortunately, it's expensive products, and
mm-hmm.
it's long hours, and it's a lot of employees, and it's the best china and the best silver, which, you know, is not cheap, you know,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, so it's like, you know, it's not a profitable game, but it's something that we do for passion and love, you know, and it's like, for us, And when we started Cezanne, that's all we wanted to do. And, you know, we tried forever to try to find a restaurant space. We ended up just starting as a one-day-a-week pop-up because we were sick of waiting. We were so antsy to do it that we just started one day a week. And, like, we just had no investors or anything, and we shot from the hip and went for it, you know?
So how'd you find this horse barn space?
Josh was doing a project there in the commercial kitchen. It was a commercial kitchen. And then in the back, mm-hmm. there was a gallery space that was empty most of the time. And, you know, we figured we could put, you know, 9 tables in there, and we can do a 3-5 course menu, and you know, we can do it one day a week. You know, the building owners would let us, you know, rent it one day a week for this, you know, pop-up restaurant and stuff. And so that's what we did. You know, started at Cezanne on Sundays. And you know, he and I didn't have a lot of money to buy all the equipment and everything like that, and we didn't want to use any investors because it's just one day a week. So it's like, how do you do this? So we actually started off by pre-selling the reservations for the first 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone had to prepay for it, and they got their tickets just like a show. And, we were able to fill up the first 4 months and the first 2 weeks, and we were able to use the money from all the ticket sales to actually buy our plates and our silverware and our, you know, our tabletops and the pots and the pans. And, you know, it's like, and then we just had to, you know, budget and be really tight, you know, for those first 4 months. You know, it was difficult. It took a long time after that to catch up, you know, as a restaurant, you think about it, you know, business-wise financially, because we still didn't take in any investors, you know, so it was a balancing game after that.
And it was a tough space to operate in, right?
Yeah. I mean, we had a few floods there that would, like, just completely destroy everything that we had. Not equipment and stuff, like all food we had to throw away and everything, it was difficult. You know, it was like we didn't have enough electricity in the building because the building was always 150 years old, you know, it's like I was mentioning, you know, like if we're running the RoboCoop and then this person over here needs to use another blender, like if you like turn them both on at one time, the entire system would short out and we'd have to rebuild. It's like, it was horrible. We didn't have enough electricity. You know, it's like we were constantly duct taping things to keep them together.
The restaurant now truly looks like what it should look like.
It's pretty. Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
The kitchen is beautiful.
Yeah, there's everything in there that any kitchen would ever need equipment-wise. And, you know, including the Maltini stove and, you know, our great fire, and, you know, it's like, it's pretty magical, you know what I mean? That's really, you know, the beating pulse of it, you know, is the kitchen.
It's a big heart.
It's a big heart, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think half the restaurant is the kitchen.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous. Where are you from?
I'm from Chicago area. So born and raised, where I grew up with my family, my dad was a steelworker, my mom was a high school teacher. I did not grow up around fancy food. You know, it wasn't until I started working at Bellagio at 17 that, you know, I learned what foie gras was and sweetbreads, and I realized you can eat raw fish and, like, it won't kill you. And, like, you know, yeah, I did not grow up in a wine or, you know, culinary driven family.
So how'd you get the crazy idea that you would do food and drink for a living?
First trip I went to when I was in, I went to Europe with my mom and my sister, and then, you know, got exposed to food and wine there and kind of, you know, how much cultural significance it has. And then I came back and I went to college at UNLV, so I got a job at Bellagio.
Oh, so you did the hospitality program there?
I started the first 2 years. I was actually a pre-med because I had an academic scholarship for medical school, but that ended after 2 years very quickly because I realized how much I love food and wine, and I was like, you know,
just because you discovered kind of living in Las Vegas and you got a taste of.
Well, I mean, being at Bellagio, you know, and working for Michael Mina, mm-hmm. at Aqua, which is one of the best restaurants in the city at that time, you know, and I was just a busboy, you know, I was 17, but like just being around those guys, you know, and all the information. And
you were doing that to kind of put your way through school, or
yeah, I have a job. You know, I mean, I had a four-ride scholarship. I started paying for an apartment.
Yeah, right.
You know, I had to live and stuff like that. So,
So
you know, it's like. And I had a lot of interest in wine, so the sommeliers at Bellagio, until I turned 21, you know, they gave me so much education and guidance, and, you know, they allowed me to work, to become a sommelier, part of the team on my 21st birthday, which was great.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know.
What does your mom think?
Oh, she loves it. It's kind of interesting. You know, my mom actually, she's still, you know, she's very adventurous with food now. You know, she's eaten at Cezanne a couple times now, and she likes, you know, she never had abalone before, so she's like, oh, okay, what's this? You know, I'm like, just eat it, Mom. It's delicious. You know, I took her for sushi for the second time in her life, like just a couple months ago, and she's like getting into it now. She likes it, you know, there's things she likes and stuff.
Wow.
Know, it's like she's like she has no problem eating raw fish. She likes the flavors, you know, uses a little bit too much soy sauce, but it's okay, you know. At least I got her to the raw fish point.
I love that.
I work on it a little bit better now.
I've broken people's popped people's oyster cherries before.
Yeah.
It's I mean, it just makes me so happy to, you know, take, for instance, my little sister to eat in New York and show her what real sushi is all about.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. No. It's fun with her. It's fun to have my mom in San Francisco when she visits because she's adventurous now and will go out with me anywhere and eat anything. So.
I wonder what your dad would say if he were still around today.
You know, he was. I mean, who knows? You know. He'd probably make fun of me. He was a steelworker, you know, kind of like, you know, beer drinking, you know, kind of guy. You know, it's like was no wine and that fancy, you know, fancy schmancy stuff, as he'd say. You know, mm-hmm. he would probably have good fun with me, but I think he'd really enjoy what I'm doing because, you know, hopefully he would.
Because you're doing well.
Yeah, because well, you know, he did eat a lot, so I know he'd enjoy that.
He did. So he was a lover of food, and and I think he'd be. Would be proud of you, and you're like the, you know, your parents, no one in your family worked in restaurants, like you're the unlikeliest of restaurateurs.
No one at all, you know, it's like, so it's really interesting to kind of, you know, to see the, to have taken the path, you know, looking back at it sometimes, you know, it's like, you know, people ask me like, oh, hey, you know, why'd you get into restaurant ownership? And I was like, hey, bad decision making, you know, joke around with them, because it's a really hard, very stressful career, you know, and it's like, you know, it's not. I have so much respect for so many people that are in the food and wine industry, just because, you know, we all know how hard it is. So I think that's why there's a lot of camaraderie in the industry.
I like to say, unlike fashion, where people are drinking diet beverages and have to look really skinny in food, we want to feed everyone, and that's naturally sort of a loving thing.
Yeah, exactly. Nourishment.
Well, you came from some incredible. Mentors.
Oh, yeah.
For instance, Rajat Par.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's still a great mentor to me. You know, he's probably one of the best teachers. You know, he's taught and helped so many other people, too. You know, in the industry, he's such a great inspiration.
What did you learn from him?
That list is too long. We don't have enough time on the show. But, you know, I mean, not only wine, and obviously he's very Burgundy-focused himself, so it's like, you know, a lot of knowledge in Burgundy and the chance to taste a lot of great things, but, you know, also how to, you know, be a good person in the industry and, you know, how to work with other people and, you know, it's a lot of stuff in life, too, you know. He's a great mentor. So.
Biggest, you know, most best learning from Rajat or one of your, you know, the mentors that you've learned under? That really differentiates the good plus, the medium plus, from the striving for the great.
Like a great lesson learned from mentors and things. There's so many of them, you know what I mean? Whether it's from, you know, they're constant, like, beating you down, you know, the humility and make sure it's always about the guest, you know, it's always about the guest and what you're doing, and you know, it's, how you're taking care of the people around you, you know, and the staff and the people, you know, it's really kind of like, you know, they're constant reminders of how to be a better person and how to inspire everyone else and how to take care of everyone else, especially the guests, you know, because that's what it's about. You know, hospitality and everything that you do, you know? You know, wine, you know, being sommelier, you know, things like that, you know, it's not for a test and it's not for a title and it's not for money, you know, we all do it out of the passion wanting to do it, you know? It's like I started making wine because I wanted to learn the process. I wanted to make the mistakes and screw up and learn, you know, what aspects of winemaking make wine, you know, better or worse. You know, so it's like, yeah.
It's a really small world in food and beverage. You mentioned that Rajat valued, less, being a good person as well. Do you think that people are judged on that enough, you know, or, you know, is it sort of just like the folks that are successful, everyone wants to be their friend? Like, is that important?
No, I mean, the importance is just being respectful to other people in the industry, you know, being respectful to the people you work with, you know, trying to do your best to, you know, to be helpful and be supportive of everyone else. You know, it's like it's a big thing. It's a small, you know, it's a small industry when you really look at it. You know, with restaurants and wine and stuff like that. I mean, it's not a lot, and everyone talks with each other because, you know, it's like that's what you have to do. You have to be supportive and work with everyone because we all grow together as a community. We don't. It's not one person that's like, you know, the leader of the pack that like changes everything itself. It's all collaborations with everyone else and learning from each other. And, you know, trying, you know, and communicating with each other. So that communication network is very strong. So, you know, it's very important to do the right thing always.
Lots of projects in your future, some of which are not public yet, and then lots of fun travels, like you're booked out for the rest of the year. You're the busiest guy I know, and I know a lot of very busy people. I'm very impressed with you. Where are you looking forward to eating?
This year?
Yeah.
There's a lot of places I'm actually looking forward to eating. I really want to have dinner at Noma. I'll be honest with you. You know, after speaking with him and seeing him have so many accolades and those things like that, that restaurant and Faviken in Sweden. I really want to explore, you know, Northern Europe. You know, luckily, in a couple weeks, I'm gonna be able to see a couple restaurants I haven't been to before in London, which would be, you know, the Fat Duck and St. John. And Bubble Dog, the chef's table at Bubble Dog.
Mm-hmm. Delicious.
I'm sure we're going to get hot dogs beforehand and then still go to the back and eat. But, you know, it's, you know, I'm excited about it. I'm gonna get a chance to see some of the restaurants I want to see in London. But, you know, I really want to make a trip up, you know, to Northern Europe. Definitely to Sweden, you know, definitely to Copenhagen. There's so many things happening, you know. Another restaurant, actually, Geranium, is one I want to. I've heard really a lot of amazing stuff, but I really want to get to. And which also in Copenhagen. So there's a list of stuff. I'm gonna make a week long trip up there if I can actually get the reservations in 1 week all together at one time, which may be difficult because these are the hardest restaurants to get into. But right. I'll see. You know.
Mm-hmm. So with just a couple minutes left in the show, I want to assure you that I will play this show after the big surprise. But you're gonna be dining at Cezanne next week, right?
Yeah, for the first time, I'm actually going to. I'm actually going to sit down and eat in the restaurant myself for the first time, you know, after, you know, it was just like, this trip, I mean, like, really, this trip in London for these awards, you know, really, you know, it's like, reinvigorated myself. I'm not saying I wasn't, you know, excited before, but, you know, it's like, it was so inspirational to me, and it's kind of funny because, like, when you do something with your partner, you know, my partner Joshua, seems like, when we do something, a restaurant together for 5 years, we just put our heads down, and, you know, we never changed because someone told us to change, and we never did things because of the press. We've always just like put our heads down, and we did what we thought was right, and we just did it. Whether people complained about it online or not, we did what we thought was right, you know. And you know, I get a chance to eat at a lot of great restaurants all around the world and stuff. And after this, I realized, you know, that it was kind of a thumbs up. You guys are doing something really cool. But I never have experienced our own experience before. I've experienced everyone else's, but I haven't ours. So I'm actually going to sit down in the restaurant for the first time in 5.5, 6 years and experience the Cezanne dining myself, which I'm kind of, you know, I haven't done it. I haven't done it forever because, you know, kind of a superstition. I don't like to sit in my own restaurant. But, you know, I think it's something I really need to experience and, you know, and see what everyone else sees.
Are you still able to tell us your fake name that you made the reservation with?
No, I won't tell you.
You can't?
No, it's too funny.
Oh, man. Oh, that was where I was getting at with this whole interview anyway.
So secrets are meant to be kept. But none of the staff knows I'm coming, so it's just a separate reservation.
I just got one more question for you.
Yeah.
Biggest surprise of, you know, from starting your own a restaurant that you own, and then now seeing some recognition for it. Congratulations. What's been the biggest surprise about doing this on your own with your partner, Josh?
Wow. You know, I mean, there's been so many.
What you didn't realize maybe when you first started.
You know, I mean, probably the most exciting. I mean, the Pellegrino Award was absolutely phenomenal, you know. And, you know, I really think, you know, when we got our second Michelin star, that was not that, you know, it's like we worked really hard and we were hoping for whatever we can, you know, we'd be happy with whatever they wish to, you know, put on and stuff like that. But that was such an honor and like such a, you know, such surprise. And, you know, I remember when they announced it, I was actually in Hong Kong Because they do a wine show at the end of October every year, and they generally announce it at the end of October every year. And I was in Hong Kong, and I got the phone call from Josh, and it was just like, you know, it was a very emotional moment, you know, for both of us and those things, even though we weren't together. But, you know, he called me immediately, obviously, so. But, yeah, that was a good phone call, you know, I mean. But there's been, you know, I don't know, I mean, there's been so many great things that have come out of Saison over the last 5.5 years. Not just accolades, but, you know, the support of other people in the industry that we have, you know, that we have so much respect for, and people that we looked up to for a long time that come in and, like, you know, have enjoyed themselves so much. And, you know, they go around and they, you know, they share information with people saying Saison's such a great meal. You know, I mean, those are as special as anything, you know, to have our peers, you know, really enjoy it and be supportive of us and those things. I mean, it's been a fun five and a half, 6 years, but it's been interesting.
A fun ride. Get the phone call about the 2 Michelin stars, breathe a sigh of relief for just 2 minutes, and then back to work.
Yeah, pretty much that's how it is. I mean, it's, you know, it's the same thing with the Pellegrino. You know, it's like when that happened, we were like, okay, you know, it's like, so people like what we're doing. But, you know, we have to keep pushing forward. We have to keep getting better. We have to keep evolving, you know. And even, you know, no matter what happens, I think that that's just ingrained in Josh and I naturally, and I think that's just what we'll always do. No matter how far we go down the road, it's just, I mean, that's our drive, you know. Neither of us sleep, neither of us stop. We just keep going.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come on today, Mark.
Oh, no, absolutely. A pleasure. It was very fun. So I got to think back at some fun memories too. So it was
good. I dug. Some social media info, as always, hashtag WOM Show. That's word of mouth show. At Leitihsu, LEITIHSU on Twitter. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/ word of mouth with Leitihsu, all spelled out. And Mark Bright, you can tweet at him at Saison SF Som. SAISONSFSOMM. That was sommelier and partner Mark Bright of Saison Restaurant in San Francisco. We're recording on April 30th, 2014 from our partner Stitcher Smart Radio in San Francisco. You're listening to Word of Mouth with Leitihsu on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Leiti. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.